This holiday season, give the gift that everyone actually wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. From USDA-certified very tender filet mignons and perfectly aged ribeyes, to juicy burgers and gourmet sides and desserts that make every meal unforgettable, Omaha Steaks brings steakhouse quality flavor straight to your doorstep. Whether you're gifting family across the country or filling your own freezer, every box arrives perfectly packaged and guaranteed to impress. Because nothing says I love you most like a gift of Omaha Steaks. Skip the malls and the guessing. Go to omahasteaks.com right now. That's omahasteaks.com to save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Hurry, this deal won't last. Omaha Steaks, delivering joy since 1917. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a really close look at the very top tier of global decision-making. You know, there's big international summits, the G20, G7, where leaders gather, promising to, well, steer us away from crisis.
Right.
The world watches these things.
Right. They're presented as absolutely essential.
Exactly. But what if, and this is the core question today, what if these gatherings have actually fundamentally failed? Our deep dive is centered around a, let's say, pretty powerful critique by Sandeep Mehra. It argues that modern global leadership has basically collapsed.
Collapsed. That's a strong word.
It is. And that the whole pursuit of peace has become more like a sterile performance. So our mission today is really twofold. Unpack why these summits are failing, according to this source, and then explore the proposed path forward, something called awakened diplomacy.
And it's crucial work, I think, because this critique, it goes beyond just, you know, policy tweaks. It really challenges the ethical core of how nations interact. Mehra's analysis points to this, well, devastating paradox. The very things meant to secure peace, they've turned into rituals.
Rituals, meaning empty gestures.
Pretty much. Staged harmony, you know, instead of genuine problem solving. And the source argues this makes the world safer for the politicians involved, maybe, but definitely not for the rest of us, not for people.
Okay, so that's a central contradiction we need to unpack for you. Every summit gets hyped as the moment, right? The turning point.
Always. This time it's different.
Yeah, the indispensable gathering. But the source is saying, nope, they just collapse into ceremony, leaving humanity exposed.
Exposed to the very dangers they claim they're tackling. So we really need to explore that gap, that huge gap between the image of power and control and the substance, or lack thereof, the failure.
Okay, let's get right into the mechanics then. How does this failure actually happen? Because when we watch the news, we see the end product, don't we? The declarations, the handshake.
The photo ops, very important.
Very important. But what's going on behind that curtain? The source describes this pattern, apparently decades long, that actively undermines the whole promise of finding lasting peace.
Yeah, let's call the performance versus the substance, like you said earlier. The failure is sort of engineered, built into the process through relying too heavily on these visuals of success.
Like the staged unity you mentioned.
Exactly. The perfect photo op, everyone smiling. Then these very formal, very sanitized declarations get issued. But the real talks, the negotiations, they're private. And they're structured, the source claims, less around protecting human life collectively.
And more around?
More around protecting the specific political interests of the countries sitting at the table.
Okay, so it's like a stage play. The source calls it the script and staged unity, right?
That's the phrase, yes. And you have to understand the role of the Sherpas here. These are the senior officials, the diplomats.
The ones doing the legwork beforehand.
Right. They negotiate something like 95% of the final communique text, sometimes weeks, even months, before the leaders even arrive. So by the time the presidents and prime ministers show up for the cameras,
the deal is basically done. The text is locked.
Largely, yes. And the source argues the real failure often happens right there in that prep phase, because alliance politics dictates the script. The outcomes are shaped, maybe even predetermined, by existing geopolitical alignments.
So leaders aren't arriving fresh to solve problems.
Less often than you'd think. According to this view, they're often arriving to sort of legitimize compromises that were already hammered out. Compromises designed primarily to avoid offending anyone important. It makes the actual summit, the face-to-face meeting of leaders, almost redundant. in terms of real substance anyway. It just becomes a ritual to rubber stamp things.
Okay, but hang on a second. Isn't that just practical? I mean, if you've got 20 powerful, often competing nations in one room, don't you need that pre-negotiation, that compromise?
That's a fair point.
Otherwise, wouldn't it just be chaos, total gridlock? Doesn't the source kind of ignore the practical reality of needing consensus?
It acknowledges the difficulty, definitely. But it argues the kind of compromise reached is the problem. It's fundamentally flawed. It points out that even close allies, countries you expect to be on the same page, often show up divided on really crucial questions.
Especially the ethical ones.
Especially ethical ones, yeah. Like human rights, or when intervention is justified. They can't agree on a single clear stance. And when that basic unity is missing, the goal seems to shift. It's less about solving the actual problem.
And more about?
Just producing a document. Any document. Something everyone can just barely sign off on. This leads to what people in diplomacy call footnote culture. If a country really dislikes a phrase,
they water it down.
They either water it down until it's meaningless, or they insist on adding a little footnote saying, well, we don't really agree with this bit.
Mm-hmm.
So the compromise isn't actually finding a solution. It's finding the lowest, blandest common denominator that avoids a public fight.
That really paints a picture of collapsing into ceremony. And the outcome of this whole ritual is what the source calls the noise and silence. Can you unpack that?
Yeah, it's a powerful image. You get the big spectacle first, that the noise, the world gathers, promises are amplified, lots of political rhetoric.
Declarations signed with flashing cameras.
Absolutely. Huge media attention.
Mm.
But then the silence, that lasting clarity, the kind of actionable ethical agreement needed to actually fix things,
mm-hmm.
It's deliberately avoided.
So the world gathers in noise.
And departs in silence. And the consequence is pretty chilling, isn't it? That moment that sold as global unity is, in reality, often deeply superficial. The toughest problems, the ones needing real moral clarity, they get kicked down the road because the consensus needed to solve them was basically traded away for the stage harmony needed for the photo op.
Right. Sacrifice for the sake of appearance.
Exactly. Now, if we look at the wider implications of this, these summits, they project this image of guardianship, right? They're meant to be the world's protectors, guarding peace.
The global guardrails.
That's a good way to put it. But Mara argues their internal substance is actually division, calculation, leaders focusing on, you know, immediate national games or political optics.
Rather than genuine human protection.
Precisely. And the consequence for us, for humanity, we're left exposed. Critically exposed to the very dangers, climate change, conflict, pandemics, that these summits claim to be resolving. Why? Because the leaders couldn't or wouldn't agree on what constitutes a threat universally or how to respond with one standard.
And a source calls this?
A visible, stark collapse of leadership. It's framed as a fundamental failure of responsibility, where the performance, the image of guardianship, has been tragically mistaken for actual presence, for real, principled action. That's the structural failure at the heart of it all.
Okay, so that's the structural failure, the mechanics. Now let's shift gears a bit, because the source argues there's a deeper failure too, a failure of philosophy almost. This is where the critique gets, well, really sharp. It argues the greatest failure of modern diplomacy isn't logistics or process, it's moral.
A moral failure. How so?
It's the refusal, the persistent refusal to protect human life with one single non-negotiable standard, a fundamental ethical baseline that applies to everyone, everywhere.
Ah, okay. So not having a universal definition of what's sacred.
Exactly. The source calls it the definition deficit. Think about it. Leaders will debate trade rules, carbon credits, borders for days on end, highly technical stuff. Yet, they consistently dodge the ethical core. They fail to agree on that universal standard for life. Like, when does destroying human life become terrorism or an utterly unconscionable act, regardless of the flag or the cause?
And you see this play out all the time, don't you? The diplomatic maneuvering to avoid calling something what it appears to be.
Absolutely. Just think how hard it is to get even two major countries to agree on whether a specific armed group is a freedom movement or a terrorist organization.
Because the label depends entirely on their political relationship with that group or its sponsors.
Right. They view the definition through the lens of political utility, not ethical clarity. Is this group useful to us?
Yeah.
Or problematic?
And the consequence of that, of not having that shared ethical standard, is just disastrous, isn't it? Some deaths spark global outrage, immediate condemnation, calls for action, emergency summits.
While others?
Others are ignored, or worse, rationalized away. Unfortunate, but necessary. Collateral damage. It all depends. Judgment ends up following the author who did it. What's their political affiliation? What cause do they claim? Instead of the fundamental nature of the act itself.
So instead of saying, look, deliberately targeting civilians is just wrong, full stop, always, the conversation becomes...
It becomes, well, who did it? And does condemning them serve my country's strategic interests right now?
Yeah.
The moral clarity just evaporates.
It makes violence seem conditional. Sometimes, okay, sometimes not.
Exactly. Violence becomes just another tool in the geopolitical toolbox, sometimes legitimate, sometimes not, depending entirely on whose hand is wielding it and why. And Mira puts this so clearly in the source material. There's a quote that really nails it.
What does it say?
It says, "Peace will never come from leaders who cannot even agree on what it means to value a human life. Terrorism is not the flag or the cause. It is the conscious choice to turn death into a weapon."
Wow. The conscious choice to turn death into a weapon. That cuts through the political labels.
It does. And the quote finishes, "Until leadership returns to one definition, one standard, and one truth, the world will keep gathering in noise and departing in silence, leaving humanity unprotected." It really connects that definitional failure directly to the silence, the inaction we talked about.
And it highlights how this lack of definition gets baked into the system, right? It becomes institutionalized. International summits don't just accidentally lack clarity, according to this critique. They actively turn this moral silence into, well, into official policy.
How so? Through the documents they produce.
Exactly. Their final communiques, they mention peace all the time. It's everywhere. But the word feels empty, hollow. Because that non-negotiable definition of what they are protecting, the inherent value of every human life, is deliberately left fuzzy or left out altogether.
So peace becomes just ornamental.
That's the word the source uses, yeah.
Yeah.
Ornamental. It's like a diplomatic requirement, a box you have to tick in the preamble. It's something nice and flowery for the press release. But it's not treated as a real covenant, a binding agreement that actually governs how nations behave. It's like having, I don't know, fire safety rules that nobody actually enforces because it might upset someone powerful.
And it's in that gap, that definitional void, that the legitimization of violence really takes root. Mm. When the moral red line is missing or blurred,
yeah,
then the misuse of power can be framed as policy.
Precisely. Aggressive military action gets called necessary security measures. Crippling economic blockades are just strategy. And the immense suffering of ordinary people, that's just unfortunate collateral damage. It gets normalized.
And what does this do to institutions that are supposed to uphold justice? Like The Hague, the International Criminal Court. Well, that's deeply concerning. Those institutions, they're designed, in theory, to hold law above raw power. They rely on universal ideas of human dignity, of what constitutes a crime against humanity. But without that foundational standard, we've been talking about the unconditional, non-negotiable value of all human life. Even the pursuit of truth at places like The Hague can appear to bend.
Bend to politics.
Bend to the political interests and pressures of the major powers. If the very definition of a crime or who gets investigated for it seems dependent on the political winds,
then the law loses its moral authority, doesn't it? It stops feeling universal.
It risks becoming just another tool of convenience, used sometimes, ignored other times. Instead of being that sacred covenant of justice it's meant to be. When summits fail to establish and uphold that unconditional standard, they basically give a quiet diplomatic nod to actions that exist in a moral gray zone. It ensures the legal system is always navigating a political minefield, not clear moral ground.
So the whole system ends up managing crises rather than preventing them by standing firm on truth.
That's the argument, yes. A system designed for convenience, not clarity.
Okay, so this critique paints a pretty bleak picture. A failure of structure, a failure of moral definition, leading to a collapse of leadership and trust. But crucially, the source material doesn't just leave us there in the diagnosis. It offers a path forward, a very specific, maybe even revolutionary set of concepts. Awakened diplomacy, awakened leadership, and awakened governance. This is the proposed solution.
Right. It moves from critique to construction.
Exactly. So let's start with awakened diplomacy. What does that actually mean? The source describes it as a practice of conscious clarity.
Conscious clarity. It means starting where conventional politics usually ends or avoids altogether. It starts with the ethical essence, the unconditional value of life. It demands that leaders approach every negotiation, every decision, not primarily through the lens of what's in it for my nation, but through the lens of this single, non-negotiable moral truth.
Anchoring everything in the value of human life.
Yes. And if you do that, if that's your anchor, then the acts that violate life terrorism, deliberate war against civilians, coercion, causing mass deprivation, They all carry one meaning. They are violations of the foundational standard of humanity, period. It gets instantly through all that political noise and strategic ambiguity we discussed.
So no more arguing about whether it's freedom fighting or terrorism based on who's doing it.
Under awakened diplomacy, that debate becomes irrelevant. The act itself, the conscious choice to harm life, is judged against the one standard. And this changes everything. International agreements stop being these cynical exercises in compromise where you trade away an ethical principle for some political or economic gain.
They become
true covenants, real solemn agreements designed to protect humanity universally with that single standard. It establishes a moral floor, a baseline for all international relations going forward. It fundamentally shifts the goal, you see, from just preserving national interests to preserving human integrity.
That's a profound shift. Awakened diplomacy basically rewrites the rules of negotiation. A leader walks in asking, how does this protect human life? Not, what can I get away with? But how does this become structural? How do you build this into the system? That brings us to awakened governance, right?
Exactly. Awakened governance is the necessary infrastructure. It's the framework, the architecture, that allows global institutions, the UN, maybe the World Bank, regional bodies, to actually function with dignity and real authority again. You could call it the infrastructure of integrity.
Infrastructure of integrity. I like that. What does it do specifically?
What's critical is that this framework is designed to ensure that systems of law, systems of power, remain accountable to clarity, not to convenience. Remember, convenience is what gives us those watered-down communiques, the empty definitions of peace. Clarity demands that these systems stick unconditionally to the first principle, protecting human life. Above strategic calculations, above national self-interest.
So it builds in accountability.
Yes, and transparency. Transparency around the motives behind the use of power. Is this action genuinely aimed at upholding the first principle, or is it serving some other agenda?
That distinction, clarity versus convenience, seems absolutely central here. So if a decision is convenient for, say, three big countries, but everyone knows it will cause terrible suffering in a smaller country, awakened governance would say.
It would say the decision is illegitimate. Because it violates the higher principle of human protection. Accountability would kick in, forcing a reevaluation based on the core ethic, not just political ease.
Okay. Diplomacy focused on clarity, governance built on integrity. But you need people to make this happen, which leads to awakened leadership.
Precisely. This ties it all together. The source argues that leadership has to embody presence, not just perform it. Performance, again, is the ritual we talked about. The photo op, the carefully scripted statement, the backroom calculations. Presence is different. Presence is described as conscious, mindful responsibility. It's being fully aware of the human impact of every single decision and grounding those decisions in the clarity of that first principle, the value of life.
So it's about the leader's internal state, their intention.
Very much so. It means decisions have to be taken with a genuine, holistic sense of responsibility for humanity, not just for your own nation's short-term interests or your approval ratings or pleasing your allies. The survival of peace, Mara argues, depends entirely on restoring this. We have to stop confusing the image, the performance of leadership with the truth of leadership, which is presence and integrity.
Can you give a practical example of the difference?
Sure. Think about foreign aid. A performing leader might ask, will sending this aid package win us influence in that region? Will it look good back home? An awakened leader, grounded in presence, asks, does this aid package genuinely meet the fundamental human needs of the people affected? Is it being delivered without political strings that compromise their dignity? It shifts the entire focus from transactional politics to principled impact.
That's a huge shift. It suggests the crisis we're seeing isn't just about flawed policies, is it? It's almost like an ethical or spiritual exhaustion within the global power structure itself.
I think there's a fair reading of the source's implication, yes.
Yeah.
Which is why it issues this really strong demand. It calls on nations, on the summits themselves, on all the institutions responsible for peace, to basically look in the mirror, to confront their real intentions, their actual priorities, their very reason for being.
Like an existential audit for global power.
Exactly. A deep, honest look. And the central demand emerging from that audit has to be this. The future of peace depends on truth without distortion. It requires a diplomacy, a governance, a leadership that puts humanity and core human values right at the absolute center of every decision. Not as an afterthought, not as a side issue, but as the driving force.
No more treating human suffering as collateral damage to be managed, but as the primary signal that the system is failing.
Precisely. It has to be the core guiding driver. And the source is quite clear about what happens when life is truly honored as the first principle. The outcomes change dramatically.
In what ways?
Well, three interconnected things happen, according to this framework. First, decisions gain legitimacy. They stop being constantly questioned as self-serving moves because they're rooted in a universal moral standard people intuitively recognize as right.
Okay, legitimacy. What else?
Second, the outcomes gain embodiment. That's an interesting word. It means they have real substance, real meaning. They aren't just pieces of paper or temporary fixes. They represent a genuine behavioral, ethical shift in how power operates on the world stage. The commitment is felt. It's real, not just symbolic.
Legitimacy, embodiment, and the third.
Trust. Both leadership and the institutions themselves start to recover trust. And trust is arguably the rarest, most valuable commodity in global politics today, isn't it?
Absolutely. It feels like it's at an all-time low.
Exactly. Because performance has replaced presence for so long. But when leaders are consistently seen upholding an unconditional truth, acting with integrity even when it's inconvenient, trust can be rebuilt. And then finally, peace stops being just a slogan you put on a banner. It becomes what it always should have been, a core, non-negotiable responsibility of governance.
So these three concepts, awaken diplomacy, governance, and leadership, they aren't just abstract ideas. They're presented as the engine for a real-world movement.
Yes. The source frames them as the foundation of the awakened leadership movement, which is led by Sundeep Mehra. It's described as a global conscious movement. Its focus is on restoring vision where institutions have lost their way, bringing, well, genuine awakening where governance has become just a formality, a ritual.
And it aims to redefine leadership how?
Not through traditional politics, not left or right, but by aligning with what the source calls the soul and systems of global power. It's about transforming the fundamental nature of governance itself in nations, in big corporations, in society from the inside out, aligning actions with core human values.
And there's a sense of urgency to this.
Very much so. The argument is that the illusion of unity created by these ceremonial summits hasn't just failed to help, it's actually deepened suffering globally. By putting on a show of harmony while doing nothing substantive, these rituals inadvertently shield those who do wage violence or cause harm, while leaving ordinary citizens feeling unprotected and deeply cynical.
So the message is pretty stark. The era of just performing harmony needs to end.
That's the call. The critical task now, according to this view, is to awaken diplomacy and governance into a state of clarity. A clarity that refuses to be compromised by political convenience or narrow national interest. It forces a confrontation with the real moral cost of our current way of doing things.
This has been a really deep dive. It gives you, the listener, a completely different lens for analyzing global events, doesn't it? So just to quickly recap that core contrast, what we have now, largely, is diplomacy focused on staged harmony, on complex calculations of alliance politics, on convenience, the diplomatic ritual.
Right. Performance over presence.
And the path forward proposed here, the vision of awakened diplomacy, demands integrity above all. It requires adopting that one single non-negotiable standard for the value of human life. And it insists on conscious clarity, even when, especially when it's inconvenient.
It really reframes the whole problem. The efficacy of global cooperation isn't really about logistics or funding or even technical expertise at its core. It's fundamentally a question of ethical willingness. Do leaders have the courage to anchor themselves in truth?
And this critique is so valuable because it forces us, all of us, to question the basic assumptions underlying global cooperation. If that foundation is flawed, if we refuse to define life as non-negotiable,
then the outcomes will always be fragile, illusory, built on sand.
So global governance faces this choice. Does it want to be remembered by history as performance or as integrity? That choice confronts every leader, every institution right now.
Which brings us to the final provocative thought for you, our listener, to take away from this deep dive. If awakened diplomacy demands this radical shift towards clarity over convenience at the highest levels, the geopolitical level, then what about in our own lives, in your work, in your community, maybe even just in your own habits of thought? What specific system or habit or maybe even a relationship in your own sphere, however small it seems, could you examine today? Where could you choose conscious clarity over comfortable convenience? Because the principles of integrity, ultimately, they apply everywhere. They start within.
This holiday season, give the gift that everyone actually wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. From USDA-certified very tender filet mignons and perfectly aged ribeyes to juicy burgers and gourmet sides and desserts that make every meal unforgettable, Omaha Steaks brings steakhouse quality flavor straight to your doorstep. Whether you're gifting family across the country or filling your own freezer, every box arrives perfectly packaged and guaranteed to impress. Because nothing says I love you most like a gift of Omaha Steaks. Skip the malls and the guessing. Go to omahasteaks.com right now. That's omahasteaks.com to save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Hurry, this deal won't last. Omaha Steaks, delivering joy since 1917. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.